The State Department of Health is holding a public hearing in Hilo on Wednesday regarding the future of a new power plant. That facility, Huhonua on the Humukua coast, would burn trees to generate electricity. Some point to it as a model of renewable energy. Others say, not so fast. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
Bioenergy is the use of biological materials to generate electricity. The fuel for that process is called biomass and can include timber residue, green waste from farms and gardens, or even human and animal waste. The Huhonua Bioenergy Project in Pepeakeo plans to burn eucalyptus trees to generate up to 30 megawatts of electricity per day. That process was recently declared both renewable and carbon neutral by the U.S. Departments of Energy, Agriculture, and the EPA. But the reality is a little more complicated.
Renewable is a resource that can be replenished at the rate it's being consumed.
That's Michael Cooney, a researcher with the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute.
This forest, whether it's renewable or not, I think they're talking about cutting down the eucalyptus forests. Whether or not it's renewable has everything to do with how they harvest it. And, you know, if they harvest it slow enough that the trees regrow at the rate at which they're cutting them down, it's a renewable resource.
But Cooney says that's a big if.
Different trees grow at different rates, and they're going to grow at different rates based upon the environment in which they're in. Because if they're harvesting 5 acres per day, then you times that by 365. That's what they might say is the minimum size of the forest that they need. But the reality of it is, how many years does it take one of those eucalyptus trees to go from a seedling all the way up to a full-grown tree that they're going to harvest? And eucalyptus is considered one of the more faster-growing, so it's probably got a window of around, I've heard and I've read, around 10 years. So that's the math that you got to work through. It's not an unreasonable thing in proposing a forest for biomass that the forest will replenish itself. However, anybody can completely harvest inappropriately and destroy a forest overnight. I mean, that's definitely in the realm, too. It just depends upon how good of foresters these people are.
That matters because in 2015, the state of Hawaii passed a law requiring power producers to be 100% renewable by 2045. Designating Huhonua as a renewable operation allows Hawaii Island's power utility to meet that requirement. But there is also the issue of carbon emissions. Remember, the federal government considers this a carbon-neutral process, but that is a hotly contested issue globally.
The consensus is that everybody's right. It all depends upon what wood is being burned and how it's being burned. The combustion process of woody biomass is complicated. The kind of biomass that you're burning, whether it's dense wood and eucalyptus versus agricultural waste, they all have different energy densities. So they're going to burn differently. And then you have different kind of reactors in which that burning, it goes on, how much oxygen is brought in, how well you have the gaseous mixtures. And so you get some combustion processes that are very dirty because they're at lower temperatures. They have incomplete combustion. You get lots of soot, a lot of byproducts. And there's others that actually enhance the temperatures at which it combusts by even adding in some fuels of its own, and they could be much cleaner. So there is no one answer there, and it has everything to do with the technology used and the biomass source being burned and how that biomass source has been pre-processed. Is it still moist or is it bone dry, for example? Because if there's water in the biomass that hasn't been fully dehydrated, it hasn't been fully removed, then some of the energy when that biomass burns just goes into boiling off the water. And so that has the effect of keeping the combustion temperatures lower, right? Because when you boil water, the temperature stays at the boiling temperature until the water is gone, and then the gas, the vapor heats up. So all the reports that you're reading are correct. They're not necessarily in conflict because you're not comparing apples to apples. You're comparing an orange to a pineapple to an apple to a banana.
Water is another major concern with the project. The Huhonua plant will pump 21 million gallons of brackish groundwater every day. That water will be used to cool the system and then pumped back underground through several nearby wells. That was a red flag to Kuhan Pakmander, organizer of the community environmental watchdog group Malama Hamakua.
We have landslides quite frequently, and these injection wells are only 80 feet from the cliff line. And they will have chemicals. They will not be thermally appropriate for very sensitive coral reefs. And we don't know how they're going to treat it when it goes back. It will not be thermally appropriate. And they'll add about 24 chemicals into the waste stream.
According to Huhonua, water going into the injection wells will not affect the nearby ocean or mix with drinking water, but that doesn't satisfy Malama Hamakua.
We are assured that it won't be a threat because it's a Malka to Mackay flow, and therefore the drinking water wells, which are Malka, won't be affected. But they've also said in their own studies, well, that there are no studies. They said, we really have done no studies. We don't know what the geology is of that area that we're going to be pumping water and drawing water. So I think that is where the public is most concerned. There's never been any environmental review of this project. There's never been an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment. There have never been any studies. So here we are with a big electrical plant that's proposing to do extremely impactful actions to every aspect of our natural resources, and there hasn't been a single study. It's shocking. We want studies of the impacts of the hydrology. We want studies of the geology. We want to know how it will impact. We don't want a project of this magnitude to just be guessing as it plows forward.
Huhonua strongly disagrees with Malama Hamakua's assessment. Company President Warren Lee maintains that the company is following all environmental laws and has worked closely with state and county regulators.
There is environmental compliance based on the review. It is exhaustive. This doesn't happen in months. I mean, the engineers that designed the plant, they're all experts. They know what the regulations are, and the thing is to comply with the regulations, not to subvert the regulations, whether it applies to air, land, water. We believe we comply with our applications that we submitted for it. And if there's any concerns that are identified by the respective reviewing agency, we will address them. And they will not issue a permit unless they feel that the rules and the regulations of the respective agencies are met.
I asked Warren Lee about some of the specific environmental concerns raised by Malama Hamakua. He told me that water injected into the ground wells will be a few degrees warmer than its natural temperature, but the company's computer modeling estimates that this will produce a warming effect of less than half a degree Fahrenheit at the ocean floor around the plant. Lee also stated that any chemical discharge will be within safe parts per million levels set by regulators. I also asked him about the plant's sustainability and carbon emissions.
Our plan is to operate as to what we call carbon neutral. So for every tree from a managed forest we cut, the plan is to replant and take into account also any carbon emitters, such as heavy equipment that is used in the process. So it could be that, for example, every 20 trees we cut, we'll be planting 21 to make sure that it is a carbon neutral feedstock. It's probably going to produce energy at a rate that will save Hawaii Electric Light Company ratepayers a significant amount of money over the life of the contract, which is 30 years. So it is a sustainable project, it's green, and it's renewable. I mean, every 7 years. The eucalyptus that we're looking at, the replanting, could be a 5 to 7 year cycle. And if you look at other types of technologies that may be available, windmills right now, and windmills are not dispatchable 24/7. You look at solar electric, they're not dispatchable 24/7 because the sun goes down. There is no energy. Now, if you had a battery, it would be very expensive for the ratepayers if they had something equivalent to this bioenergy plant where solar electric or wind power becomes available 24/7 with a full battery backup.
Although the Huhonua project was not legally required to conduct a more stringent state-level environmental impact assessment, it was asked to complete a similar review by Hawaii County. Jeffrey Darrow is with the Hawaii County Department of Planning.
In this particular case, the planning director had asked the applicant to submit a document that addresses all potential impacts and how they were going to mitigate those potential impacts. In this particular case, they addressed the existing facility, how they were going to improve it, how that facility was going to operate, what sort of impacts that facility would have on clean air, on drainage issues, on surrounding properties, on noise levels, on historic sites, on cultural sites, on the shoreline area. It's not to say that this facility wasn't going to have impacts. Every type of use has some sort of impact. The reality is, can those impacts be mitigated through some type of condition or some type of action? And so in reviewing the document, they felt like these impacts could be mitigated through standard conditions placed on the applicant if approved.
But state regulators are also involved. On Wednesday, the Department of Health is holding a public hearing on Huhonua's permit application. Joanna Sito is with the Safe Drinking Water Branch.
So we look at all of the discharges that are going to be placed into the groundwater. We have a study that was done by our Department of Health on the impact of the chemicals to water and drinking water. We believe that the drinking water will not be affected by this discharge. However, we are going to be looking at the confirmation of that determination. Just because a permit is issued, that does not mean that that is the end all. The permit can be a living document with additional conditions input as needed for the protection of the environment.
Several lawsuits have been filed seeking to force a more stringent environmental review. The case of a Hilo resident seeking to block the project was thrown out by a judge in September, and a separate challenge was recently heard by the state Supreme Court. A decision has not yet been made in that case, which centered around greenhouse gas emissions. The Department of Health has no timeline for making a decision on the permit application, but said that it's committed to addressing all of the public's concerns. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
That health department hearing will be taking place tomorrow at the Imiloa Astronomy Center in Hilo. It will include an informational briefing starting at 10 with public testimony at 1 p.m. We'll have the details posted on hawaiipublicradio.org, including the email address where you can submit written testimony. And full disclosure, Huhonua Bioenergy is a former HPR underwriter. This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.
For 35 years, HPR has been enriching minds and nurturing spirits. Be a part of preserving that legacy with a planned gift today. Your gift will sustain HPR's excellence and ensure our quality service and programming for coming generations. Donors who make HPR a beneficiary of their will, trust, retirement plan, or life insurance policy become members of our Legacy Society. Please call this station to find out how you can contribute to our future.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We all know termites have a really bad reputation in Hawaii, especially among homeowners who've seen their properties ransacked by the little critters. Unlike the creatures they take their name from, the Hawaii Ukulele Supergroup, the termites received nothing but positive acclaim throughout their career. Formed in 1972, the termites consisted of Jason Mitsunaga, Dean Guzman, Milton Chun, and Michael Guna. Now, the group was so popular, it was hired to perform a jingle for a drink product that was popular throughout the islands. For our quiz today, can you remember the name of that drink? Well, to stir up your memory, the jingle talked about the drink going round, 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 down, down, down in your glass, glass, glass. If you think you know what forgotten treat we're talking about, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. The announcement by Hagedorn Commercial Printing that it will lay off 92 workers as it reorganizes is still rippling through the community. Clint Schroeder is president and chief operating officer. He explains how a 25% tariff hike and technological changes led to the erosion of its core business of publishing.
Obviously, this was a decision that was, you know, not easily reached, nor was it reached quickly. I think the executives of the Hagedorn Corporation, the ownership, and I did as much as we could sort of in advance to make sure that we were prepared to answer any questions that we could and about the surviving companies and the severance for those that will not go on with those the two other organizations. So folks are really plugged into getting the work done that we need to get done over the next 60 days and working on a solid transition plan to make it as smooth as possible.
How many employees will be retained?
There are approximately 26 employees between the Hagedorn Digital Organization and the Hagedorn Media Group that will be moving into a new location closer to town, and we're working on that location right now.
And what about the vendors that you folks worked with? Who stands to be affected immediately?
Well, you know, obviously we work with several paper vendors for Sheetfed, which are local, Spicers and Veritiv. We have a fairly significant volume with the both of them. So we're working through some of those lists in priority order. Of course, this is there's not a filing associated with this, so no legal protections or anything like that. So we have our AR and AP responsibilities. You know, we'll meet all of our obligations and those types of things. You know, obviously our clients, I think, are most curious right now on where they will go, and we're working on those two case by case and making recommendations for appropriate vendors and making sure that they get the same service and quality that they've come to expect from the Hagedorn Printing Company. Those are probably our top priority, at least now for the next couple of weeks, just making sure that everyone is comfortable with what needs to happen next and again, you know, really working on that transition overall.
For listeners who may pick up those publications, I mean, which ones are we talking about?
So not only just publications, but, you know, Sheetfed Work, which runs the gamut from all of the tourist-type brochures that you see in Waikiki at the airport, to retail stores, catalogs, things that you get in your mail. Macy's, Costco, Walmart are some of our largest accounts here. So the things that you typically see in this market from either of those three major retailers mostly come from the Hagedorn Printing Company. So we're working in conjunction with a lot of their marketing agencies right now to get a nice transition for them after the first of the year into, again, appropriate shops that can handle that type of work.
We've been hearing about the tariffs and the potential effect for many months now. How much of that played into your decision to shut down the company?
There were a lot of factors that played into the final decision, and that was really just one and sort of kind of came on us right at toward the tail end of the decision-making process. It was a serious factor, though. For Rollstock, we bring our heat set Rollstock, which is our web press. We bring half of that in from China and half of it in from Canada. So only half of the stock is affected, but it's two of the most commonly used grades of paper, and those are not available from our Canadian vendor. And, I obviously have had a lot of feedback, a lot of comments. Why don't we buy domestic roll stock? And the easiest answer to that is most of these grades are not available domestically anymore. So even the mainland printers that utilize this type of coated paper are buying it from Canadian resources and some out of China too. Our geographic location allows us to, you know, really shop the Chinese market for that paper. Whereas, you know, someone maybe located in the Midwest or the East Coast, it wouldn't be as efficient an option. But really, the paper markets have changed so much in the last decade. A lot of the paper mills that were domestically owned at one point have either shut down or they've been converted into doing other types of paper, uncoated stocks like newsprint, for example, or packaging or cardboards, corrugated. So a lot of these plants, you know, have really already been retooled to provide a product that is more popular and more widely used than roll stock papers, both coated and uncoated. So for us, the tariff of 25% on some of these, there's really not a whole lot of option except to pay it. And so the margins in this type of work are such that it would be impossible not to pass that on to our clients, or at least the majority of that material's cost. And unfortunately, many of our clients being, in the same sort of economic conditions industry-wide that we are really going to be unable to pay those types of premiums. So with some of the transitions that will be made for our larger clients, like, say, Macy's, Costco, Walmart, they will probably be able to absorb some of the print work back into mainland printers that are working on different stocks, and they'll have to make those transitions and then just zone their inserts and ship them here. You know, when we start to look at some of the chain of custody for the papers that we use and we work with, we really try to focus on things like the Forestry Stewardship Council, FSC certified, which basically means that we're working with paper mills that know exactly where their pulps are coming from, and that, you know, it's not a, you know, we're not working with mills that can't track back to, deforestation and those kinds of things. The papers that we use are typically from pulps and trees that are responsibly grown and harvested for the specific reason to make paper. And that's becoming a whole lot harder to certify, first and foremost, and secondly, to find outside of some of our preferred vendors, which are now obviously being subject to some of these tariffs. So when we look at the paper industry in total, it's a commodity, so it goes up and down all the time. But really, it's been so incredibly volatile the last couple of years that it's been almost impossible to predict and forecast for our clients what type of material cost increases that they'll be subject to. This change is just one that layers a whole different cost structure on the top of that, you know, already existing volatility. So, you know, you're right in saying there are other alternatives, looking at eucalyptus trees, looking at bamboo papers, and some of those things. But it's really not in mainstream production yet. So traditional fibers and hardwoods are really where most of these types of papers are coming from. And it is, like I said, it's a tough market anyway. And with this on top of it, it's making it even more difficult.
I remember when Weyerhaeuser shut down and there was lots of concern because, you know, they were producing a lot of the pizza boxes, I think, if I mm-hmm. recall. And that there had to be this adjustment, you know, with businesses across the state because that supplier wasn't there anymore.
You know, and this will be an adjustment too. But, you know, the majority of the work that we do on our three sheet-fed presses, our two digital presses, our large format presses, you know, our mail house and our bindery, can be handled by some of the smaller companies that are here in town. Edwards Enterprises, Honblue, for example, are two of our competitors that we've always had a really friendly relationship with. Both have, you know, solid, talented people and good products with great quality. So a lot of the transition that we'll be helping our clients make, I'm hoping, is more out of peace of mind and you know, making sure that their schedules and the things that they need, the products that they require, get handled as efficiently as possible. And we've already obviously been talking to both of those particular organizations to make sure that we, you know, can transition these very important accounts of ours over within the next 60 days so that nobody misses a beat and people are still able to produce what they require. You know, one of the things that really contributed to this overall and has been coming for really the last 12 years, the core of our business, when the five companies that came together that formed the Hagedorn Printing Company in 1996, the core of our business was publications and regional and local publishers and all of the magazines. Many of the titles that still exist that you see in the market, you can probably think of. Over those 12 years, though, the competition has become incredibly, incredibly fierce. It's only been recently, within the last 5 or 6 years, that, you know, we've kind of branched out into the digital space. And, you know, unfortunately, it was maybe too little too late. While it has been a significant growth area for us in the last 5 or 6 years, just not enough to keep up with the natural erosion of those publishers and publications off of our top line. We all know how we consume information differently these days. So you're right, we are all struggling with the, you know, adaption to different formats, especially in such a capital-intensive business as, you know, traditional media or a printing company, commercial printing company, because we have so much heavy equipment and such a big space and so many people to make it all come together, that's a really hard corner to turn quickly. And you know, really those escalating costs are certainly a factor for everyone that's going through challenging times in this industry.
That was Hagedorn CEO Clint Schroeder. Now, the company plans to keep its Hagedorn Media Group, which publishes This Week and Visitor and retail publications, and Hagedorn Digital, which provides graphic design, social media, and other web-based services. Hagedorn Hawaii is owned by the Hagedorn Corporation based in Idaho. It's time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us to talk about a new approach to urban design. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, so we're talking about these pop-up parklets, right, that I've seen around town?
This program is so new that there's not even a name for it yet. But okay. Yeah, you're definitely on target, and it's coming out of the city's transportation department, Department of Transportation Services. And the idea is to get the community engaged, to get people out of their cars, to walk more, make our streets safer. In many ways, it kind of springs from the 2012 Complete Streets Plan, right, that the city's been working on. So we're not going to see how it will exactly unfold, but you mentioned pop-up. Well, the idea here is that people in the community, average folks, would actually say, look, I've got a dangerous street in my neighborhood, or I've got an intersection where there's a lot of problems, and to propose a way to improve it. Well, what could that entail? Well, you could put in maybe more bike lanes, maybe a roundabout, maybe a mini park. You could have those curb extensions like you saw in Chinatown, maybe even nicely painted crosswalks. Any number of ideas to make it a more livable community. And this is something that the city will be unfurling sometime next year.
Now, I didn't realize that this was kind of a worldwide like trend.
Yeah, it is. It certainly, you have to look to San Francisco, of course, in many ways. That city is always ahead of the curve on these sorts of things. But they started looking at this in 2005, actually taking parking areas and converting them into like mini green areas. So people, you know, won't drive and park their car. They'll actually walk. There's actually a phenomenon known as parking day, where at least for a while, parking lots are converted into livable areas, not just used for parking your cars. This was surprising. This is Natanya Friedheim's story, by the way. I got to give her credit. I didn't realize that, but in most U.S. cities, 80% of the paved areas, public space, go to cars. 80% are being used up by cars.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, I remember seeing these parklets in Chinatown. Yeah. I think architect Dean Sakamoto with his group Shade, they were doing something in Chinatown, I think even Waipahu.
Right. And by the way, you mentioned that there has been pushback in some of these cases. I mentioned the bulb outs in Chinatown that we're talking about, but also the King Street bike lane, even though that's now been around for a while, that still is something that hasn't completely worked out, even though the city is looking to expand bike lanes. But there is pushback. It will take the community looking at things differently, working with the city on how to make a more livable community. I think one of the main concerns that comes into this is pedestrian fatalities. And in that regard, the numbers are just shocking. I think we are up this year over previous years, skyrocketing fatalities, particularly for our elderly citizens. So this is the idea is not only to get people out of their cars, to make sure that more people are not hit by them.
Right, and it is a big concern for both the city and the state. So I guess if the community can figure out a way to make their neighborhood safer, if it includes some of these parklets or, you know, modifications,
right.
It's worth
the
a
city
shot.
Will actually, the city will actually offer materials and technical know-how, and even the public could potentially be involved in actually building these little parklets or whatever the case may be. It's called tactical urbanism, a phrase I wasn't familiar with until now, but as a way to get people directly involved in the way their city looks.
So now, when will this kind of get rolled out?
The time isn't specific. Natanya mentioned in her story that there are, in her words, a few kinks to be worked out, but the plan is for 2019, and certainly we will be following through on whatever comes about. I tell you, there's an intersection near where I work here in Kaimuki that I'd like to see people just slow down and be more careful. I just really worry there's going to be more accidents. So if we could make it an easier, safer Honolulu, that would be a win-win for everybody.
Right, and it'd be interesting to see then if they can adopt some of those things in the neighbor islands where they may have some of the same problems.
Right. And by the way, some of these changes might just be temporary. And if they took, then maybe they would be made permanent.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. On November 20th, a week from today, groups across the country will remember those who died in acts of anti-transgender violence. The Transgender Day of Remembrance follows Transgender Awareness Week. Now, the State Health Department recently released a report on transgender issues, the first of its kind. Lance Ching gives a snapshot of our transgender community.
Well, in the state of Hawaii, the findings from our report were very profound. What we learned is something that is not surprising, quite actually. For example, there are many health indicators for which our transgender youth are doing poor compared to many of their peers. And unfortunately, this touches many different aspects, including mental health, also substance use and violence. For example, in 2017, what we learned is that many of our transgender youth said that they are experiencing sexual dating violence. One in four also said that they were physically forced into having sexual intercourse. And another 40% also said that they were bullied, either on school campus or also electronically. And so many of these types of stressors, which can be prevalent and chronic, can have a profound and enduring effect that can last well into adulthood. And in fact, when we looked at 2017, half of our transgender youth said that they were sad or depressed. And unfortunately, without interventions, we also learned that half of our transgender youth attempted suicide in 2017.
I mean, that's pretty scary.
It's very scary. And it really harks back to the fact that we really need to act on these data. And so it's not so much important to just do the surveillance, but we really need to develop programs to be able to address the health needs of our transgender community.
So this was really the first report that was compiled on this issue?
Yes, that is exactly true. This is the very first report of its kind in the state of Hawaii that addresses the health needs of our transgender community. What's interesting is that the creation of this report was really mobilized and motivated by our community. And so it was created in solidarity with our transgender community and with the support of more than 25 different community partners and multiple programs across the Department of Health.
And so what about funding? Is this report going to, you know, go forward, be an annual thing?
That's a great question. This year, the funding was provided through the Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion Division at the Department of Health. But one of the important things that came out of this whole adventure was that the Department of Health convened a work group with community partners. And so it's a work group that consists of 25 different external partners. And the goal initially was to produce this report. But we also understand that there is a lot more work that needs to be done. And so in November, we are actually reconvening the group to partly share in some of the successes of the past year, but also to roll up our sleeves and to think about ways in which we can sustain this effort and learn of new ways in which we can build upon each other's efforts and our resources.
Nationally, there's an observance of transgender issues, right? Explain that.
Exactly. So the second week of November is Transgender Awareness Week, and this is followed by National Transgender Day of Remembrance on November 20th. And so at the University of Hawaii, the Hawaii Health and Harm Reduction Center is sponsoring an event in observance of this day on November 20th. And so the public is free to join them. And it's going to be at the Kamakakua Kalani Center for Hawaiian Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa from 5:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. And the purpose of this day and the evening is really set aside to honor and to remember those from our transgender community who were lost to violence. And so it's free and open to the public.
And is there something symbolic about being up there at the School of Hawaiian Knowledge? You know, because culturally, I think there's just more of an acceptance in Pacific Island cultures.
That is definitely the case. I would definitely say that in terms of being transgendered, one's gender is in itself culturally informed. There are many cultures across the world, including the Native Hawaiians, that recognize a third gender or some other gender. So, for example, for Native Hawaiian culture, we have the Mahu Wahine and the Mahu Kane. India, for example, has theirs. There are several other Polynesian cultures that also have a third gender, and also the Native American culture as well.
The idea then behind this study is to draw attention to some of the needs of this group. Do you have a handle on how many make up this community?
That's a great question. So currently, based upon our surveillance among high school students in our public school system, we estimate that about 3%, so roughly 1,200 public high school students, self-identify as transgender. However, Hawaii actually has one of the largest populations of people per capita who identify as transgender. We estimate roughly around 8,500 people statewide recognize themselves as transgender.
And you mentioned bullying, and I know that's a big issue right now in our schools. They're wrestling with that. You know, I don't know what this report does as far as offer ideas and what might be best practices to deal with this?
Yes, the report actually provides a lot of national recommendations. For example, one national recommendation for bullying and harassment is to have more comprehensive health and sexual education. Studies have shown, for example, that students who are exposed to health and sexual education that is inclusive of sexual and gender minorities are less likely to bully other students and not just transgender people. We know that nationally there are about four states as well as the District of Columbia that have explicit laws requiring comprehensive health and sexual education. In Hawaii, we don't prohibit, but we also don't enforce or have an inclusion of this type in our laws. We first started presenting the findings from the report, and we've already shared it with numerous policymakers and community stakeholders. The findings were first shared at the Hawaii Health Association's inaugural conference, and this was their healthcare conference. And since then, it's led to other requests for presentations. And so we've presented some of our findings to the University of Hawaii, various community organizations, and also a legislative task force that is really focused on producing mental health services for LGBTQ. What I basically also want to say is that, you know, reports such as these are profound, and they're quite eye-opening for sure, and they have value from a public health perspective, undoubtedly. But they also serve a much greater purpose, and that purpose is to give visibility to a community. So if you don't ask the questions and you don't collect the data, you are in effect saying that this population and many of the health issues and inequities that they're experiencing and facing day in and day out don't exist or don't matter. And so this report is a reminder to people everywhere that transgender people exist and that they are very much a part of Hawaii's fabric.
So acknowledge, give a voice.
Right.
Don't silence.
Exactly. And if I may add, the story of Hawaii's transgender community is not just one of doom and gloom. There are actually numerous stories of strength and resiliency that you can find in our report. For example, there is Bianca Tanaka, who was harassed throughout her life and through her struggles, remarkably became empowered and wants to now serve as a positive influence for her community on Kauai Island.
And there are other role models in the community.
There are, and we have several of those stories. And, you know, these might not be high-profile transgender members of our community. These are regular folks who you might find at the grocery store in our schools. And they're there ready to provide and link youth with resources. And there are many resources within our community. There's programs like Ahamahu and the Kua'ana Project. And there are gay-straight alliances. And many people ready to build resiliency in our youth.
Right. And I'm just thinking, I know, I think with the film festival, there is the film on Hina as an educator and the outreach that she's done.
Right. And Hina was actually, I would love to say, she was a major contributor to this report as well. And she provided a lot of community insight of how to make it better. We initially approached Hina with just a lot of data. And she came back to us and she said, you know what, this data is great, but you really need to balance it with that strength, that stories, those stories that are coming from the community. And so we went back to the community and we gathered those stories. And now we have, I think, a much better report as a result of it. And it's one of my favorite sections now of the entire report.
That was chronic disease epidemiologist Lance Ching talking about the transgender report issued by the State Health Department. Here in Hawaii, the Transgender Day of Remembrance takes place November 20th.
Do you consider yourself a creative and strategic thinker? Do you have a way with words and a love of digital communications? Are you a multitasker and a people person with management experience? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you might be interested in our opening for Director of Marketing and Communications. Find the full job description and application details on the HPR website.
This morning, we focused on the termites, not the ones attacking your home's foundation. We're thinking of the ukulele supergroup formed in 1972 that consisted of Jason Mitsunaga, Dean Guzman, Milton Chun, and Michael Agunep. Now, the group became well-known throughout the islands, especially after it performed the commercial jingle for a local concentrated fruit drink. For our quiz, we asked you to tell us the name of the beverage, and to jog your memory, we told you part of the jingle. It goes round, 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 down, down, down in your glass, 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 and makes your mind think yum, yum, yum. Sung along to the tune of Round and Round by Perry Como. Now, the drink we were looking for is that orangeade called Exchange. And that was the answer to today's quiz. And congrats to John Hiroshima of Honolulu. You got that right. This was a very popular quiz. We had lots of phone calls all across the island. Raymond from Kaka'ako remembers pouring Exchange into ice cubes to make mini pops. And, you know, we were checking with our callers, and lots of folks said they preferred the orange flavor over grape. And that was today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you might hear it on a future show. That's it. That's the Backyard Quiz.
Aloha, I'm taiko artist Kenny Endo. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
The number of rat lungworm cases inched up this month by two more for a total of seven. Now, officials are doing more to reach out to the community to emphasize food safety. School gardens are becoming more popular across the state, and Lydie Burnell of the Farm to School Hui sat down with us recently.
The Hawaii Farm to School Hui formed in 2010. We are a statewide network composed of 5 island-level networks, community organizations, schools, and state agency partners. And our mission is to strengthen Hawaii's farm to school movement. And when we talk about farm to school, we're looking at improving school food through local procurement and scratch cooking. We're talking about school gardening, which directly connects children to where their food comes from through experiential, place-based, hands-on learning. And we're also talking about farm-to-school education, which can include agriculture, nutrition, culinary, health, food systems, anything related to food. This is all part of a holistic picture of farm-to-school.
And you've been doing this for the past decade.
Yes, this work has been growing over time. The Hawaii Island School Garden Network was one of the first ones to form through the Kohala Center, and they had coordinators that were able to be point people for schools to do consultations. How do I start a garden? How do I improve my garden? How do I integrate it with my core curriculum at school? And what are the best practices around garden-based learning and farm to school?
And I remember doing a story over at Alawai Elementary. I think Jack Johnson had a big day with the kids in the garden.
Yes, so Kokua Hawaii Foundation is also one of the leaders in this movement. Their Aina in Schools program is a farm to school program, and it launched in 2006. And it has a curriculum for K through 6 where they're gardening, they're composting, they're learning about nutrition. It's very successful.
And I know the concern is lately on food safety, particularly with the whole rat lungworm disease and the problems that we're having. So what are you folks rolling out?
So when we became aware of this as an issue, we decided that it was very important to proactively communicate best practices around school garden safety, so the growing, harvesting, and handling of foods from a school garden. So our Hawaii Farm to School Hui created a school garden safety manual in 2016, and we offered trainings around the state with the help of the Department of Health. So this covered, you know, rat lungworm disease prevention and other basic safety practices for students, for teachers and volunteers in school gardens. So we're in the process of updating the actual manual. What's also been developed is a curriculum through UH Hilo, College of Pharmacy, that is aimed for students in grades 5 through 8. And it's really a STEM curriculum. It brings lesson plans on integrated pest management, data collection, and really, it's a citizen science project to be gathering data, which no one else in the state currently is statewide, what species of slugs and snails are out there, because we know that all of them can carry rat lungworm disease, but some of them are more likely to. So the semi-slug being one of those. No one that we're aware of is currently looking at the distribution of that species and others. So this curriculum helps teachers and students in a garden to practice safety, number one, and secondly, to be learning about the disease, to be preventing it, of course, and to be gathering critical data that will help our state make decisions and be responsive to this. So the recommendation for preventing rat lungworm disease is to check thoroughly any fresh foods that you're going to eat, to wash them thoroughly. So check and wash. And if it's lettuce, you're taking apart a head of lettuce leaf by leaf and inspecting it. And then, of course, cooking will also kill the parasite.
It sounds easy, but I know a lot of folks were very concerned when we had so many cases last year. And the big deal was, oh, well, what about our schools? What about our keiki that are involved in the, you know, they're out in the gardens harvesting our fruits and vegetables?
Mm-hmm. So in general, as a teacher or parent, you might want to consider what crops you want to grow with students. So certain things are easier to check and wash than others. So we all like to eat lettuce, but it may not be something that you would want to grow with a preschool class. There are other things that could grow well in a school garden and kind of save those riskier crops for upper grades where they're more able to have that quality control, if you will.
I guess maybe these kids will take some of these lessons learned and translate into home gardens if they've got them at home.
Yes, actually, that's a great point. Really, we see this rat lungworm disease education as a way to spread the message broadly for greatly increased awareness.
Yeah. The kids learn these lessons and they teach the parents.
They teach the parents, absolutely.
Gosh, so what's the schedule for rolling this all out?
So right now, our expert and curriculum designer, Kay Howe, who was a researcher at UH Hilo, is delivering a professional development workshops on Hawaii Island to cover the curriculum. And we would like to see those rolled out statewide on an annual basis.
Okay, so then over the next several months, Big Island first, because that's kind of ground zero, and then it'll go to the other islands.
Pending support. So this is something that the state could be investing in order to have these trainings offered. The curriculum is available for free online from the UH Hilo College of Pharmacy website, and the School Garden Safety Manual is also available at farmtoschoolhui.org.
Okay. Anything else? Was there anything particularly tricky in developing this new curriculum, new guidelines?
Actually, I think it's been a great partnership. We've worked with the Hawaii Department of Education STEM specialists to align it to some of the things that they're encouraging teachers to look at in terms of STEM. I also wanted to say that not only will the students educate their parents, but they're also able to watch out for their younger siblings if they're educated about rat lungworm disease.
That was Lydie Brunel, coordinator for the Hawaii Farm to School Hui, talking about outreach efforts to improve food safety and minimize the threat of rat lungworm disease. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we take a look at an airplane graveyard in the Pacific. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. The number to call, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter on HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.